Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, March the 20th, 2025. This is episode 3,644 of the Survival Podcast. As we complete another week of new shows anyway. Of course, there will be a Friday flashback tomorrow. And tomorrow, if you're coming to Alvord, Texas for the beef processing workshop, you'll see me and my grandson there. I'm really looking forward to getting away for a couple days. I kind of need an unwind, unplug, replug, reboot type thing. But before we get to that, I will give you one more new show this week. This will be a doozy because it is Expert Counsel Q&A. I got a great lineup of experts for you today. Dr. Ron Paul will talk about Trump's anti-war words not matching his actions and relevance to Yemen. I'm going to do something rare in this. I'm going to actually kind of disagree with Ron and Dan a little bit. Just a little bit, in that this isn't so cut and dry. When people start shooting at your boats, right, in a pinch point like the Red Sea, now, there might be some ways to, like, stop it without blowing the shit out of them, but I'm just going to say, when you start firing rockets at U.S. ships, you're going to get blown up. And you can debate whether you should or not, but let me tell you something. The people doing it, you know what's coming. When they recently shot down one of our drones, I'm like, oh, this is going to be bad. So I don't know if it's disagree. It's more of a different take on the reality on the ground here. Joel Riles will talk about using good timing and proper correction without going overboard with your dog. One of the things, and he's not really coming at it from this way. It's more like, you know, you brought your correction up to, let's say, a 5 out of 10. And the dog now doesn't need a 5 out of 10 when you correct it. You can come down to a 2, but you don't. That's definitely a problem. Another problem, and I'll talk on this a little bit when Joel does his, is we have a tendency to treat dogs like kids and they're not. And I'll explain that when we get to that segment. Mike Melito will talk about choosing sights for your handgun. In this case, it's a really cool 1911 that the gentleman's asking about, but he's going to give it of a more general advice because not everybody owns 1911s or even the specific model this guy has. Matt Sersley, the Gores tax attorney, has a mixed bag for you guys today. He's going to be talking on taxes on income for your children, itemized versus standard deductions, and real estate inheritance all in one. And some good stuff from Matt. Carrie Brown, who'll talk about foraging, specifically in this case, trees with edible blossoms you can forage. I hadn't had time to skim this one yet and listen to the whole thing. I only listened to the very beginning. He's talking about red buds, and they're blooming right now. And I'm wondering if he'll get the locusts, because black locusts are fixing to go off here, and they're one of my favorite. Very short term, you get about 2, maybe 3 weeks, and I get about 3 or 4 weeks of black locust blossom only because there's so many different microclimates on my property. So each of the trees will go in at different times that they'll start to bloom. We'll see if he mentions black locusts in this. Nicole Sauce is going to add on to our discussion we had last week, where I had a gentleman on it. One of the harder interviews I've ever had to do is to talk to a man about the death of his daughter. Especially, you know, when I got the app, I didn't know until the day I did that interview that she'd only died like a month prior to that. It's pretty still raw of a wound, maybe a month and a half. It's really raw at that point. But Nicole has some additional advice if you're planning on traveling abroad or you have loved ones doing so. This is an important subject. And then I'm going to talk to you guys, kind of building off of yesterday for my segment. We're going to talk about why inflation and economic shift is going to be full-on cancer for people right now who are in their 30s to 40s. Specifically like 30 to 40. And I'm not saying if you're 29, you can forget about it. If you're 41, you're fine. I'm just saying the people that are going to get hit in the balls with this, you know, I'm talking the next 10 years, so those people are going to be 40 to 50 over that 10-year period. And there's a lot of things that change in your life during that period, and a lot of things you're not good at changing once you go that far, and you've kind of set your way as to what your career is going to be, what you're going to do. You've been promoted a couple times or something like that, especially if you don't own a business, or if you own a business that is very centric on like one segment of the economy. There were a lot of people that were really successful construction companies, one way or another. They were either subcontractors and drywallers and stuff, or they were building full houses, or they were doing home repairs and stuff like that. And when the 2008 real estate bubble popped, there were people that, you know, were driving around in F-350s that were $80,000 pickup trucks at the time. They'd beat $120,000 trucks a day, and they were fine. They could pay all their bills. Their kids were happy. They were all, and then plop, right? So I think we have to look at this from a variety of standpoint. The W-2 employee, the entrepreneur, both of them in that age range, there's a lot of things you need to pay attention to, like AI and what have you, to be able to be adaptable. The other side of this, and I'm coming at it more from today, is the erosion and the cancer that is inflation for people in that space. Because your prime savings years, where you're trying to make your nut with your investments that you put away, is going to be the exact same period where I believe we're going to have a return to really nasty inflation. And even standard inflation is a lie at this point. When they say it's 2, it's 4. When they say it's 4, it's like 8. And that is a cancer. And if you're not adequately preparing yourself for that, and there's only a few ways you can do it, right? There's more than one way to do it, but there's only a few ways that you can do it. You either have to lean out your future expenses in a big way, or you have to do much better with your money, and I'm going to dare say that the better tactic is to try to do both. And it really is the case that they actually feed each other if you do it right. So that'll be my anchor segment. With that, I just want to remind you real quick, if you like this show and the work that we do here, the number one thing you can do to support us is become a Member Support Brigade member. It's really easy to do. You go to the Survival Podcast and click on members, or do /members and sign up. It's $50 a year. That's all. $50 a year. It's about 18 cents an episode is what it comes out to if you were paying for the show. Of course, the show is free. There's a lot of discounts. I'm going to tell you, if you are in this audience and you use cannabis product, for instance, right there, if you're not a member, you hate money. I'm telling you, as soon as you look at what you can save on top quality cannabis product, you already hate money. But I don't do that. Okay, great. You don't do that. Do you buy seeds and plants? Yeah, then if you're not a member, you hate money. And there is a ton of other ways that you can get great discounts. Just go to the website, look at the list of discount vendors, and I'm telling you, if you use 2 or 3 times a year you use them, you're going to at least break even. And if you do more than that, you're putting money in your pocket. So it doesn't really cost anything to really support this show. Of course, the other way is start your online shopping at tspaz.com. Just go there when you're going to buy something online, and no matter what you buy, you help us out. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on Trump's anti-war words versus his actions now in Yemen. And I'm going to say this, Chris Rossini over there did not do the greatest job of editing this out of the gate. It's a little bit off, but I think it'll make sense. And I'm going to come back and tell you my thoughts on it.
This is one when President Trump was candidate Trump, and he's complaining about, you might want to get your earpiece, he's complaining about Biden being too much of a warmonger. You just pick up the phone and listen to what he says here.
I look at your policies, I see secure the borders, bring jobs back. I look at the Democrats and many Republicans, and it's foreign war and foreign expansion.
That's right.
What is that?
I think it's just a failed mentality. It's crazy. You can solve problems over a telephone. Instead, they start dropping bombs. I see recently they're dropping bombs all over Yemen. You don't have to do that. You can talk in such a way where they respect you and they listen to you. Viktor Orban.
Now, here's as a candidate. We don't need you dropping bombs. We can pick up the phone. And now he goes ahead and starts dropping some bombs.
You know, when we were looking for an item of optimism, we would say, well, we'll give him a pass the first go around. He didn't know that much about running the presidency, and he hired a couple people that weren't really his friends, and they were doing things behind his back. But he's had a lot of time, four years of president and 4 years now, and then he makes the statements. The statements are good, but we're still doing the same thing. And I think it's obviously the case of serving certain special interests in foreign policy that causes this to happen. Because it doesn't happen just for anybody, you know, but Yemen and Israel and Iran, that's a mixed bag and it's a mess. And but we could use Trump's statement.
Yeah.
Well, we could sell it by a telephone, but I'd make sure it's long distance and they were paying the bill.
Well, the whole origin of this, of course, is the Israeli slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza. At least 50,000 have been killed, most of them women and children. And Yemen said, well, we're not going to stand for it. We're not going to let Israeli ships pass. And so the United States, instead of saying, you guys need to cool it down a little bit, they said, oh, have some more weapons, have some more money to buy weapons and kill more kids. And so Yemen decided that they would interdict Israeli ships. So the U.S. put themselves in the middle of it, doing the bidding of Israel, really. And that's how we got to the situation. But, you know, a lot of people are saying now, and I had a lot of people respond to something I posted on X over the weekend. Well, we have to protect the shipping lanes. Don't they realize? Well, first of all, Yemen is not attacking anybody but Israel. But now that we started bombing them, they said, we're going to attack you too. Well, that's understandable. But Thomas Massey, always the coolest head in the class, he went and did a little bit of research. And if you skip ahead to that next one, they say these are crucial shipping lanes. Well, Massey looked at it and he said, expressed in billions of dollars, the five countries and five corporations that will benefit most from U.S. military activity to eliminate shipping disruptions caused by the Houthis near the Red Sea. China is number one. U.S. isn't even in the top five. So these are the countries that benefit from the U.S. clearing out the Red Sea. So basically, we're doing the heavy lifting, not only for five foreign countries, but for five foreign corporations. Good find on Massey's part. And if you go to the next one, here's how he explains it too. He said, regarding U.S. activity in Yemen, I recently said to watch out for a new military engagement to compensate for the pullback in Ukraine. The military-industrial complex demands about $50 billion a year from our government, above and beyond what's necessary to defend our country. So 1-2 punch from Thomas Massey on this, I think.
Boy, that's for sure.
So as I said, I'm gonna be just a little bit contrarian here. I actually agree with pretty much everything that was said, but I also kind of am trying to bring in a little bit of reality here. The truth is we do not know the intelligence that's being provided to the president. And of that intelligence, we don't know what he's being told that's true and what he's being told that's false. Can he trust, you know, the team, you know, the DNI, Tulsi Gabbard, how they can be trusted? The people, you know, it's still a big, giant mess, a group of entities cobbling all this stuff together. But my personal belief is that Trump mostly trusts that intelligence. And so we have no idea what he knows that may be true or untrue. And the world is different in the seat of command is something that, you know, we learned that in the military. It's really easy to second guess your sergeant until you're the sergeant. And then it's really easy to second guess your SFC when you're the sergeant. And then it's really easy for you to second guess your captain, etc., because you're not responsible for what that person's doing. So I really, in my opinion, I don't really know here. I have heard this argument that I just heard there. I completely agree with Massey, by the way, that there are five countries and five corporations, none of which are American, who will benefit the most from this, and maybe they should be, you know, doing the heavy lifting. I get that. But the argument, like I said, that I've heard is that, you know, they're only shooting at the Israelis. Well, I'm just here to tell you that's not exactly true. They have shot at ships under U.S. flags. They have fired on U.S. military ships. And it is unreasonable that you would expect, based on the relationship of the Israelis and the Americans, that when they are cohabitating in the Red Sea, that you could just shoot at Israeli flagged ships and the Americans would do nothing. Like, what I'm saying is the Houthis know exactly what they're doing. And it ain't like the Israelis are the only ones they've ever had a problem with or had a problem with them. You know who bombed the living piss out of them for years? The Saudis. Like, we are back to the old reality here. This is not a peaceful part of the world. It isn't. And the further away we can get from it, the better. But the problem with that is, in spite of this idea that, well, there's other countries that benefit more by the Red Sea being open and the Suez Canal, et cetera, and the passes than us, it doesn't mean that there's no vital U.S. interest in that staying open. And we live in an interconnected world. So I agree with what they're saying, but I also caution people to take just a half a step back and realize that it's not about trust, because I don't trust anybody, including Donald Trump. But there is a point where we do have to acknowledge that there are people in our government that know things that we don't know. And sometimes, and if you were in that position, you might do things differently than you think. This is not an easy binary decision here. Unless the decision is going to be, we're out. We're just out, and you guys are on your own. And I would endorse that, but I also don't think it's politically tenable to do. I don't think it can be done right now. I don't think the will is there to get it done. So take that and do with it as you will. I'm sure I'll get some hate mail over it about how I just want to kill all the poor olive farmers or some stupid shit. And if you believe that, I'm sorry. That's not the way it was. Like, Israel is full of nothing but a bunch of Palestinians farming olives, and the big, mean Israelis came in after World War II and took everything. That's not how it worked. I'm sorry. I'm not going to go into the history of the region today. I'll just tell you it's not that way. Let's talk now about dog training. This will wrap up Joel Riles' four-part series on dog training. This one on being careful with your correction levels and timing so that we're not overcorrecting and causing more problems than we're resolving.
Hello, TSP crew. This is Joel Riles coming to you again from Fortress Canine and Canine Academy with another Expert Counsel segment. And this is going to be the final in our little mini-series of the biggest mistakes that I see handlers making when they're trying to train their dogs. So today we're going to talk about timing of your corrections and having corrections that are a little too harsh. So oftentimes what will happen is if you're training your dog and you start giving corrections and they start to cower at all, they start to like respond preemptively to a correction by either locking up and like not wanting to move forward, or by overreacting when you give a command, like acting like they're going to get corrected even when you haven't corrected them yet. What's happening here is you've either, your timing is really off on using your lead, or you're not giving enough praise, or your corrections are too harsh. All right. So as we go through this process, we want to make sure that we give a correction that encourages the dog to do what we want them to do, but isn't too much for the dog. Now, here's where some people go wrong. We start to incrementally increase our correction intensity, right? So our dog does something, we give a light little correction, they don't respond to it, so we give a slightly harder correction. They don't respond to it, we give a slightly harder correction. We find that spot where they actually start responding to our commands, but that's usually maybe two steps harsher than what your dog is going to need in the long run. So what happens is, okay, they kind of got to get like, oh, that actually really hurts, I don't want that correction, before they'll start to respond initially. But then once they understand the commands, they start to get more used to our communication, they start understanding better what it is that we want from them, and our movement together starts to become more fluid, they don't need that level of correction anymore. You can come down off of that. And this is typically starts to really show up in what we refer to as the dog's intermediate stage of training, right? So when they're a pup, we usually err on the side of lighter corrections, but sometimes they'll ramp up just a little bit depending on how stubborn that puppy is. And then as the dog gets a little bit bigger, they're almost full size, so we're starting to use harder corrections on them, but they don't really need those harder corrections, or they start to react. Now, there's a couple of things that can be happening here. Sometimes, because the intermediate stage is often where we start to add more stress to the exercises that we're doing, and the dogs will react to that stress, and we'll go, I know you know what I'm asking you to do, why aren't you doing it? We increase the correction. And what we fail to realize is the dog's not hesitating because they don't understand the correction. They're hesitating because the stress is higher. Well, if the stress is higher, how can I overcome that stress in the dog without using correction and without doing what we talked about last week, which is always relying on a lead and dragging them up onto things? The way that we do that is we encourage them like we would, say, a 10-year-old who's trying to do something hard but that they're able to do, right? You can do it. Come on, buddy. You got this. And so, for instance, we'll go back to jumping up on a table example. If a dog is hesitating to jump up on a table, or maybe they do a table great, but then we want them to jump on a higher platform, like we have these mid-sized spools that are maybe a foot higher than the tables are, I know the dog's physically capable of making the jump up onto the spool, but they're hesitating because they don't quite have the confidence yet, right? It's a little bit more stressful to jump all the way up on that spool. Plus, the spool has that lip that comes out when it's laying on its side. And so if they don't make the jump fully, there's nothing for them to put their back legs on to kind of climb them their way up onto the top of the spool. So there's a little bit more stress in that situation. So rather than overcorrecting the dog, I'm going to be more encouraging to the dog during this time frame. Now, if they totally shut down on me, I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either going to take a break, or I am going to give a correction. Now, when would I take a break? I'm going to take a break if I've been working at a situation and the dog is struggling and the stress is building and building and building and building. That stress can get to a point where the dog just shuts down and won't learn anymore. So we talked about in our first segment going and taking a break or going and doing something that the dog is good at. I don't want to stay in a new exercise when I'm teaching the dog something new. I don't want to stay there if there's stress and frustration for the dog. I want to do it for a short period of time, maybe 2, 3, 5 minutes, and then I want to move on to something that they're good at, get them some praise and some reward, and then I want to come back and work the higher stress thing, and then go back and do something they're good at, and then come back and work the higher stress thing. So what happens is we have both acute stress, which is high stress in a short period of time, and we also have chronic stress. I often give this example to my clients. If I put you on something that you're slightly off balance, but you can kind of stay there, if I have you stand on something that's slightly wobbly or that you're having balance issues on, and I do it for 10 seconds, it's slightly stressful, but you're only on it for a short period of time. If I left you there for 5 minutes, that stress is going to build and build and build. Your muscles are going to start to get tired. You're going to start having trouble focusing on things, and it's going to start making you feel a little woozy, right? And so that stress is going to build. I don't know that that's fully in the chronic stage, but that's how I refer to it in dog training, right? We have the acute stress. We have the chronic stress. We don't want that chronic stress to build and build and build to the point where the dog will still shut down. So we want to take those breaks and go and give them a break and then come back. The other thing is the dog isn't fully confident that they can actually do the thing you're asking. Now, there's two aspects to this. You as the handler have to actually make sure that the dog is capable of doing this thing that you're asking them to do before you try and require them to do it. And so we do that by building up to things, right? I don't ask a dog to jump onto a table until they can jump onto a small little stool. And so once they can jump on the stool, then I go stool to table, stool to table, stool to table. Then we take the stool away and we go, now jump on the table. And then I might go stool to the taller platform, stool to the taller platform. Now take the stool away. Now try and jump up on the higher platform by itself, right? I do them in these incremental steps. Even if I'm pretty confident that the dog physically could jump up onto the spool, but in their mind, they don't understand yet that they are physically capable of that. So I kind of show them they're capable of it by giving them that little bit of transition, and then I build up to it fully by just going and doing the whole thing right off the bat. And so by doing that, I'm encouraging the dog, and I'm showing the dog, and I'm helping the dog understand, yes, you can do this thing, and I'm following all the other things we talked about. I'm not overly relying on my lead. I'm making sure my communication is clear. I'm not getting frustrated with the dog, and then I'm building the dog up to these things so that I can show them that, yes, you're capable of doing this, and then when they get it accomplished, they get that higher level of reward, because when a dog has overcome something that's more stressful, they need a higher level of reward so that it locks into their brain, oh, yeah, I did that. It was stressful and hard, but I accomplished it. I was successful and my handler's happy with me. I did what they wanted. You're going to get more and more and more of those types of behaviors out of your dog if you're encouraging rather than overcorrecting. Now, let's jump back to our timing for just a second. Oftentimes when the dog is under a slightly higher level of stress, and let's say I ask them to jump on something that's higher than they're normally used to, if I see the dog working to try and solve that problem, they're trying to gauge their distance, they're trying to gauge how hard I need to jump, they're hesitating for a minute, but they're trying to work the problem out. They're not just avoiding it. I'm not going to whap, correct the dog, fully that. I said, get up there. I'm going to be like, yeah, come on, buddy, you got this. I'm going to maybe pat the table. Come on, buddy, hop, 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 you can do it. And then after like 20, 30 seconds, if they're not committing to it, then I might grab the lead and just toss him up there and be like, oh, you did it. Good job. So it's a little stressful, but then they're like, oh, if I just get up here, then he's happy with me. And then the next time they'll be more apt to do it, right? If I do that 2-3 times and they're not fully committing to it, I'm going to go back to something that they're good at. I'm going to encourage them there, or maybe I put the spool back or the little stool back so they have that intermediate jump up before they get up there. Practice that a few more times, then go back to working it again. So all of these things are in incremental steps so that we're building the confidence of the dog as we're teaching them to do more and more stressful things, more high-level things, so that we don't get frustrated. I hope that's been helpful for you. If you want more details on how we go through these things specifically, some of the techniques and all that kind of stuff, go check out Canine Academy by visiting thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on the Canine Academy banner on the right-hand side there. It'll take you over to our website, and you can sign up. If you're looking for a fully obedience-trained or a fully protection-trained dog, check out fortresscanine.com. Always remember your ABTs, always be training. Everything you do with your dog is training your dog to do things that you either want or that you don't want. And of course, you don't want to be training your dog to do things you don't want. So keep that in mind. And until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So my caution here, which is basically everything he said, it's just coming at it from a different angle of where the correction can become excessive, both verbal and physical. And like I said, we have a tendency to think of our animals like kids, right? And we'll even hear people say things like, I'm a doggy daddy or a doggy mommy or, you know, my fur babies or whatever like that. That's fine if you just want to be cute or whatever, but it ain't true. And so what I mean by that is, let's say that you're having a problem with a 9-year-old girl, clean your room. I'm not going to do it. Okay, well, then you're grounded for one day. Well, I'm still not going to do it. Okay, well, you're grounded for the whole weekend. I hate you and I hate my life. Okay, clean your room and we can talk. They don't clean their room for the weekend. Now you're grounded for a week. You see what I'm talking about here? I'm talking about the concept of escalation. And it works on humans. It's not always the best course, but it works because eventually the human brain says, I'm not going to win at this. And so we spend most of our time in the world, most humans anyway do, dealing with other humans, both on the receiving end of that and on the delivering end of that, okay? So then we turn around and we're dealing with a dog. A dog is a much simpler animal. The dog exists in the now. So what can often happen is when you give a dog a correction and you know damn well it was enough of a correction to get the dog's attention, and the dog does it again, and you escalate that correction. And like Joel said, there is a certain significance to, you know, a certain amount of correction that gets the job done. But you might get the job done and that dog gets really excited, wants to go off again, and then you go higher than you need to. The biggest problem here is you start to break trust with the dog. You start to break that trust bond you've had. When you train a dog right, you get to a point where literally you almost never have to use physical correction. Belle is now 2.5 years old, I guess, almost 3. We don't hardly ever even put her correction collar, her prong collar, on her anymore. When she goes out and about, she's off property. I mean, all I do is Phooey. That's it. And it's like, oh man, I'm sorry, I didn't. And then the more you develop a dog to where you can do that, the more careful you have to be that you don't go past what's necessary, because then that dog starts to not trust you. When he's talking about how, like, you know, you move and the dog flinches, that dog doesn't trust you. And then that causes a whole litany of issues. And the reason I encourage you to take the approach he's given you plus this kind of mindset is where it leads with a mature dog. It leads to an animal that you can communicate with to some degree in sentences, Charlie was the extreme example of that. My buddy, he's been gone about a year now, and God, I miss him so much. But even Lucy, who was a stray, she was a couple years old when she came off the street. She had no skills, she had no obedience, no nothing. The other day we were out. Together, her and I, out taking care of the baby ducks, and the geese are having eggs, and the geese are being kind of assholes because the mama goose has eggs in the thing, and they're chasing the baby ducks away, and I'm trying to feed the baby ducks, and as I'm doing it, the one male goose is chasing the baby ducks, and I chased him out of a little bit, and he went through the gate, and he's kind of halfway between going and coming, and I just said to Lucy, I said, move his ass out of here. That's all I said. I just looked there and said, move his ass out of here, and gave her a little flick with my finger. She went and put her nose right in that goose's donut hole and goosed him the hell out of there, and then came right back out, like, look what I did. You get that by developing trust with the dog, and for the dog to trust you, you have to, and be careful, when do you turn the trust over like a kid, but you have to give the dog some trust too, so the dog feels that energy. That it's both directions. I think one of the things people really need to remember is that the dog and human co-evolved over the last 20,000 years or maybe more. We are a species that has co-evolved. We are not obviously merged biologically, but social interaction we have developed together. And even if you've never had dogs, that's still in you. Right, just like you may have never climbed a tree, but the ability to climb a tree is inside of you. Right, the dog too has developed that way, and so that trust bond is probably the most important thing that there is in dealing with a dog. With that, let's talk about handgun sights with Mike Melito.
What is going on, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Blessed to be back answering your gun and gun related questions. This one's from Robert, and it's about sights for his specific 1911. Now, I want to answer this for Robert, but I also know that there's a broad number of people listening that aren't going to be specific to this one make and model of gun. He says he has a Colt Combat Elite Mark IV series M45 ACP. That is a phenomenal gun. I have a Colt Combat Elite, and it's a phenomenal gun. Perhaps one of the best balances of like no-nonsense fighting 1911. A really good mix of just like old-school elegance and combat effectiveness. It's a good gun. You're asking about sights for it. Now here's where it can get tricky with 1911s. There have been a bunch of different cuts for a 1911. There's the original GI cut, which has the front sight integral to the slide, and then a simple, small, 3/8 dovetail in the back. And there's the one that more modern combat-style 1911s have, which is a Novak cut, N-O-V-A-K. Check some pictures, make sure that's what you have. There are some other oddball ones, but I'm pretty sure that Colt, if they don't have the factory government sights, they'll have that Novak cut. There are a lot of really good options for sights. You mentioned the Trigicons. Those are fantastic. There's nothing wrong with good Trigicon sights. You also mentioned doing something with the sights that you have. You said the white dots have worn off. And this is going to apply to a broad range of people, so let me give you a bunch of different options here. Those classic three-dot sights. Now, I like to just black out the rear sight and have a really bright front sight. That's me. Some people like the three-dot sights. Either way, here's what you do. Take some isopropyl alcohol, some rubbing alcohol, or some of that like gun scrubber degreaser made for guns because the brake cleaner sometimes will mess with finishes. Disassemble it so you just have the slide and clean it really well. Put some tape on things you don't want any paint to get on. You're not confident you can do it without making a mess. And, little tactical tip here, peanut butter. Yes, peanut butter. There's little nooks and crannies or little small pieces you don't want paint to get on. Put peanut butter on them. Wipe it off when you're done. Don't eat it. But get it prepped, spray some white spray paint in a can, not glossy, just matte, cheap white spray paint. Spray paint it in the cap, accumulate quite a bit of it in there, wait till it starts to get a little bit more viscous. Take a toothpick, dip it in that paint till you get like a drop. hold that three-dot sight up so that it's like a cup, and you drop that dot in there and let it dry. That's really it if you want the white dot back. If you want to get crazy, I still recommend doing the white dot first, but you can get some really obnoxious, like gaudy fingernail polish, talking like lime green, chartreuse, hot pink. You do the same thing with that. Don't use the brush. It's probably too big. But with a toothpick, take a drop of that and then put it on top of the white. If you don't do the white first, it may not be as bright. Put that on top of the white dot if you want a brighter color or a color that stands out. I'm partial to lime green, but you may be partial to something else. Now, some other notes for you. You said you didn't want to mess up your slides. You might want to swap out your entire slide with sights. Now, here's the thing. I love 1911s. 1911s are not Glocks. They're not like a modern polymer striker-fired handgun. They were made in an era where things were hand-fit and finished. You should not just assume that you can get a slide and put it on a different 1911. That requires quite a bit if you want both accuracy and reliability of hand-fitting and hand-tuning. And if you don't know how to do that, then don't buy another slide unless you're going to have a gunsmith do it. If you're going to have a gunsmith do something, just have a competent gunsmith replace the sights. I generally don't care, and I'll just get a brass punch and whack on that thing till it comes out and put another one in the dovetail. If you don't want that, a decent, competent, professional gunsmith will have a sight-pushing tool. You can buy this on your own, but they're pretty pricey, and you probably don't want to do that if you're just doing one gun. But a proper sight-pushing tool should not ruin your slide when you're changing out sights. They were designed for this. They were made for this. Those sights are meant to be drifted back and forth. So if you're thinking about all this extra stuff, just take it to a competent gunsmith that has a sight pusher. Ask him how he's going to change the sights. You're just going to beat him with a brass punch. There's nothing wrong with that for practical purposes, but it will leave marks on your slide. If you care about that, then take it to a gunsmith with a sight pushing tool. There are a bunch of different models of these. I've used them. I've been employed as a gunsmith. There are some that are specific to makes and models, but they should know what they're doing, and they should be able to push out sights and push in new ones without leaving a mark on the slide. And if it's like a polymer striker-fired plastic, fantastic for other people listening out there. A lot of those, yeah, you can just swap out a slide. The tolerances are way looser. You're talking about like a custom or a really nice high-end 1911, like a Colt Combat Elite. You shouldn't assume you can just swap out slides. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. But they're not designed with that in mind. Some things for other people listening out there. If you don't care about fit and finish, you can just put a little bit of tape around the sight and just spray paint the whole thing white. And then spray paint the whole thing whatever color you want. If you want a really big standout front sight, like a analog EOTech, right? Just a big bright thing to aim with. Also, Birchwood Casey makes sight paint. It comes in like little paint markers like you would get for like people that detail cars and stuff like that. They make sight paint markers. There is also stuff that I use that's super cheap. You can find it at like craft stores, hobby stores, probably Walmart, but it's called Puff Paint. And it's made for like drawing on t-shirts. It also comes with a really nice thin applicator so you can like write letters and stuff on t-shirts or something. I don't know. I don't do the t-shirt thing. But you can just put that in the dot and squeeze it in there. It's kind of like a styrofoam paint. It gets dull or dirty or you get gun oil or something on it. You can just take a small, like what you'd use for eyeglasses, flathead screwdriver, dig it out of there and replace it. Or maybe you just want to change the color. You can do that as well. And for those of you that have fiber optic sights, a lot of those are just a fiber optic pipe. It comes in varying thicknesses. A lot of times, after time, they get dull, they get brittle, they get dirty, covered in gun oil and grease and grime and stuff like that. You can clean them if you want with like alcohol, rubbing alcohol. To get that like brilliance back, they do just sell the piping. Get that at a place like Dawson Precision, some place meant for competition shooting. So if you have some old, dull fiber optic sights, you can literally just cut out the old stuff with a razor knife. If it's just the open ones that are meant to be replaced, you burn the front end with a lighter so that it's larger and it stops. can make the front of that sight as big or as small as you want. Obviously, bigger for speed, smaller for precision. You trim off the back with about an eighth of an inch. By back, I mean the part you're not looking at, and then you burn it till it sucks in tight to the sight. And that's an easy way to replace fiber optic sights. So I hope that helps. Some different options for refurbishing old sights or putting on new sights. Hey, TSP community. Appreciate you for the questions, and appreciate you, Jack, for having me on. Have a blessed day.
All right, good stuff as always from Mike Melito. He got a flood of questions, and he answered them all. And then I hadn't had any from him for a while or for him for a while. So if you want to ask some questions about guns and gear, Mike is the guy. And that's true for all of the experts. Just email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. TSPC expert in the subject line. Tell me who the question's for. Ask your question in a single sentence. Hit the return key a couple times. Give me the details that you need to give me. And I'll get them on over there. Because Mike is one of those rock stars of the expert council. You send him a question, within a day at maximum, it comes back. And that even includes on weekends. If you send a question in on a Saturday and I don't have an answer by Monday, it's probably because I didn't send it to him till Monday because I don't work weekends much anymore. Anyway, next up, let's hear from Matt Sersley, the Agorist tax attorney. He's going to give you a grab bag here. We're going to talk about taxes on the income of your children. We're going to talk about itemizing versus standard deductions and where there's some confusion there. It's really not a question of which one at all. And that's when you own a business. And then you have we have a little bit more on real estate inheritance. He gets this all well within the time limit, too. Nice 3-4 today from Matt.
Hey there, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com. Here to talk to you about keeping more money in your pocket, paying less in taxes. This week I've got a bit of a grab bag. Seen a lot of questions both to my inbox and on Facebook. And this is an area where kind of there's some general ignorance about how taxes work and how the tax code works. So I wanted to cover three separate things. The first, I've seen a couple of people talk about, well, I don't do my business expenses because I use the standard deduction. That's totally irrelevant. The standard deduction is how much you owe in taxes. Your business expenses determine whether your business had a profit or a loss, which then affects if you owe taxes. But you can take the standard deduction and still itemize all of your business expenses. The choice you have to make in your taxes is whether you itemize your personal deductions or you take the standard deduction. But you should always be itemizing all of your business expenses. The second mistake I've seen is a lot of people are asking about, well, how do I report my kids' income? And, well, you don't on your taxes. If your children have income, whether that's because they have a job, whether that's because you pay them, whether that's because they have investments, if they owe income tax, they have to pay that income tax themselves. They need to do their own filing. And while it is rare, it does happen that, you know, 1-, 2-, 3-year-olds may make enough income if they're doing certain things where they have to file federal taxes. And state taxes are quite common because some states have a very low tax threshold. So if your child has income and if they owe taxes and they're a minor, doesn't matter if they're a minor or not, they have to file their own taxes. Now, if there's they are minor, they may get hit with what's called the kiddie tax. The kiddie tax basically says sometimes they have to use your tax rate for any of their non-earned income. So if you give them a whole bunch of investments, they get taxed at your rate instead of their rate. That's to stop people from basically avoiding the taxes by giving the assets to their kids. But even then, they still have to file their own tax return. They just basically need to use information from your tax return. The third thing is not quite in the same ballpark, but it has to do with a mistake a lot of people make to avoid probate, but it ends up costing people a lot of money. So probate sucks. If someone dies, it's really a pain in the ass to have to go through everything. If you have a lot of assets, you really should consult with some sort of a legal professional about setting up a will or a trust or both. That said, I hear a lot of people who do things like, well, I don't want my kids to have to go through probate for me, so I'm going to give them my house now while I'm still alive, and that will help, that way they don't have to do probate. Well, first of all, there's a decent chance they'll have to do probate for other property anyway, so you're not necessarily saving them any money. But even if that is saving, stopping them from doing probate, you could be costing them tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes to avoid that maybe $5,000 or $10,000 probate cost. That's because of what we call the step up in basis. So when you buy a house and then sell a house, you owe tax on the change in value. So if you buy it for $100,000 20 years ago and now you sell it for $500,000, that's a $400,000 gain. Now maybe you can avoid that tax if you're an owner of the property, but maybe not. But if you give it to your kids, they're going to owe that tax. Well, if you wait until you die to give it to them, it works totally differently. And that's because the basis, the number we use for kind of what did you buy it for, becomes the value that it has on the day of your death. So in that exact same case, you have a $100,000 house that goes up to $500,000. You now pass away. Your kids sell the next day. They have no gain on that, and they owe nothing in taxes. And let's say they're paying 20% capital gain at the federal level, which is very common, and maybe they're in a state with a state capital gains tax of 2 to 3%. You literally could be talking about $80,000 or $90,000 in taxes on that situation. So to avoid the probate and a little bit of paperwork, you just potentially cost them nearly $100,000. And I've actually seen cases where it's much bigger, where it was, you know, originally about a $200,000 or $300,000 purchase and then a $2 million sale. At that point, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional taxes. So before you do anything with major financial ramifications, make sure you understand the rules. Consult with me, consult with somebody else. You can always set up a free phone call with me at agristaxadvice.com/TSP. Looking forward to talking with you. Have a great week.
I just want to add something in on this with the real estate thing. I think that, and it may not have anything at all to do with an inheritance, what I'm talking about here. People need to chill out about real estate and tax. Now, I can't necessarily tell you that some states may not have capital gains on your real estate, but the vast majority of people, when they sell a house, are not going to pay any federal income tax on it if it's their primary residence and they've been in it for, I think it's more than 2 years or something like that. I have sold a lot of houses. I have never paid capital gains tax on selling a house, and I've made a lot of money on selling a house. I think the last time I did that, my accountant told me that I could make $250,000 a year on real estate if it was a primary residence and not pay any tax on it. And so even when somebody said, well, I'm going to sell my house for, you know, $400,000, but what'd you make? What'd you pay for it? And that's what Matt's getting at too, by the way. First of all, I want to say another thing, a little add-on, and that is this whole probate thing. I don't want to go probate. I don't want to probate. Let me tell you where most of that came from. It came from people on fucking TikTok talking about how you need to avoid probate, and the person just hears the word and they don't even know what it means, and it's not as big a deal as some people fucking make it out to be. It really isn't. It really isn't. It really isn't. It really isn't. And there are certain forms of wealth that don't even really need to go through. My father-in-law died. You know, the solution there was my wife had a power of attorney for him, and we did sell his house prior to his death. Now, he didn't give it to anybody, and he didn't pay any income tax on it. We used the money from the sale of the home to finance his care. But then what that did is it liquidated everything into cash, and it was all sitting in a bank account, and it ended up being there was like $60,000 left, and there were three daughters. So we just distributed $20,000 to each daughter, never did anything else. The end finished, and that was 7 years ago. There's nothing else to be done. If you were questioned on it, audited in any way, you'd write a letter that basically says, this was inheritance. Here's a copy of the will, and there's where the money came from. Now go away. That'd be the whole thing. So let's not think that we all have super rich people problems for things like estate planning, because most of us do not. The more you have, the more these things can be problems. And the reality is, for most people, it's too much TikTok instead of, it used to be too much TV. Just my thoughts. Next up, let's hear about trees that we can forage blossoms from this time of year for eating. Yeah, not just to look at for pretty flowers. A lot of these blossoms are edible and have some really cool, unique characteristics. Let's see if Carrie talks at all about black locust blossom.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie Brown here from Strong Roots Resources. And with spring right around the corner, I wanted to bring to you guys a couple of trees with edible blossoms that you can be on the lookout for as things warm up in our region. So the first one, and one of the very earliest trees to bud out, is the redbud. These are relatively small trees. They usually don't get much over about 30 feet or so around here. They have a pretty distinctive blocky wood pattern, which can also look a little bit similar to dogwood, so make sure you know what you're looking at. But these are anywhere from bright pink to even like a deep fuchsia color blossoms, and they're wonderful. You can eat them right off the tree, and really one of my favorite ways of using it is to infuse into just room temperature water with other floral accents, other tea leaves, green tea, things of that nature. They're fairly sweet, but not overpowering. They're not as strong as something like honeysuckle is, but just super super tasty, tons of nutrition, high in vitamin C. One of those trees that is definitely providing something that a lot of us probably need as we're coming out of winter. The other one I want to bring your attention to are the cherry blossoms. We're going to see these right around at the same time coming out. And they are also more of a lighter pink, sometimes a deeper pink color. Just kind of depends on soil content and that sort of thing. And you can use those blossoms in pretty much the very same way. In fact, it's not uncommon to see cherry blossoms as part of a salad garnish or even a steak garnish, as crazy as that sounds. So take a look for those. Redbud, they tend to be a little more at forest edges. They like some shade. They don't like to be out in full sun, and they're a real standout. You'll know when they're coming out. As far as I know, redbud is certainly all up and down the East Coast. I think it's hardy to maybe zone 5 or so. I didn't quite look that up just now, but they're pretty common trees. If you want to plant redbud, you can get them from Arbor Day Society for very little money. And the cherry blossoms, the cherry trees, they're going to be a little more sun-loving, definitely need well-drained soil, but just the same, I also find them on especially south-facing forest edges here in our region. So keep an eye out for those, and if I can give you guys a hand with anything as related to foraging or homestead property development, please reach out to me at strongrootsresources@gmail.com, and I'll talk to you guys next time.
Okay, so we just got redbud. I mean, the way it started out when I was getting everything ready, I thought he might give a couple different trees. I will just tell you, right now, redbuds are everywhere. I didn't really know that they were a good flower to forage. I'll have to maybe try that, because they are right now here, like mid-March in Texas, just redbud central. Well, what's coming next are the black locusts. And if you've never tried black locust blossoms, and where you live, you have black locusts, and be sure always, I'm not going to give you a class on how to know a black locust right now, but make sure it is what you think it is. But let me tell you what a black locust blossom is like. It tastes like peas, like when you eat peas off of a plant, not pea, right? Like, it tastes like a faint flavor of pea, because they are a member of the Fabricae, the legume family. And then there's a sweetness to it. It's like this it's not super sweet like sugar, just this mild sweetness, and then it just tastes like nothing. They're really cool, and one of the best uses for them, if you're a salad eater, is to just go out and gather them right before you eat. I don't care if you cut your salad in advance or whatever. Like, they don't last real long once they come off the tree. Go out and just pick some and just sprinkle them on top of your salad. It's pretty damn good. And it just enhance, like, if you're having people over or something, you know, that you get a couple weeks a year that you can actually pull this off, because they do not store at all. It is a really cool thing to put down a salad in front of somebody with things like that. My the flowers I use on salads like that here heavily are black locust blossoms, and these are all available about the same time. A couple weeks from now, they'll all start coming out. Wild garlic flowers as well, and then we have a flower that grows crazy around here like a weed. It's called spiderwort. And those three together on a salad, man, they really just blow up what it looks like. And then if you're growing some nasturtium, you throw a little bit of nasturtium blossom on there, too. It's just off the hook. And we've talked about side hustles before, and I'll tell you that if you figure out really cool edible blossoms and you're already selling something like microgreens or something like that to high-end restaurants and chefs, that is something that you can make quite a bit of money on. You probably won't make a living on just the flowers, but it's an add-on product. It is a big money adder. With that, let's hear from Nicole Sauce on some thoughts of follow-up from last week's episode on what to do if you lose someone, they pass away while they're overseas.
Hey, TSP, Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee with an expert segment response to an episode that Jack did recently with a fellow named David who unfortunately lost his daughter while she was living abroad in Cambodia. And I wanted to just two things. One, I'm wanting to pass on my condolences because I can't even imagine what that would be like to have to function in a situation where your child has died so suddenly. So I'm really sorry for your loss. I also wanted to tag on some things that you can do if you're preparing to either travel or live abroad that can help make people better prepared if you do die, or help you with crises that can happen in your day-to-day travels. For those of you who don't know, I used to live in Germany and used to go to a lot of different countries as part of my job. And this made me refine a process for leaving town. The first one is, and this was not available so much when I was traveling, use a password manager for your digital assets, because you can set that up to where after you have passed away, somebody gets access to your key passwords for banks and those sorts of things. That will eliminate the need to hopefully get a cell phone back, like David did, to get access to accounts. And it also is a great way for them to have a list of all of your accounts. Now, there's a lot of controversy about how to do this. I will let you research the best way to do it. If you have somebody you trust to have access to all of that, you can also set them up with passwords. Personally, I have two people who I trust not to log into my accounts. Plus, they don't have access to my email without taking a few extra steps. So they have access, and if something goes wrong, they can get in there right away. And that means that your critical information, banking, social media, subscriptions, any cryptocurrency is accessible without hassle. I do love some of those services where you have the three keys for your cryptocurrency, and you have, you know, you have several of them, and then you give one to your loved one and one to a proctor, and then you keep your two so you can access it. And then if you die, they can either get the one from you they didn't have or the one from your will. Second is to keep copies of your passport and other important documents so that it's not just your hard copy of your passport, but also a photocopy and a digital copy. And I kept a copy of my driver's license, my passport, any visas that I had to obtain, and my social security card and my birth certificate. And I had printouts of those that I kept in a different place in my luggage than my passport was. So I always had my passport on my person, and I had that then also backed up elsewhere so that if something was stolen from my person but not my luggage, I had access to that. I also had a copy at home printed out in a safe that my mother had access to because she's one of my trusted people for that. And that way, if for some reason everything got robbed, I could go to an embassy, and if I could reach my mother, she could get them copies of all the necessary things to get me back on my feet and able to get out of there. This would also serve really well if you died unexpectedly overseas. Connect key contacts abroad with key contacts at home. I have a friend who every time he goes out of town, he puts me in touch with whoever he will be staying with while he's there, if he knows somebody there, and also his sister, and makes sure everybody knows his itinerary in advance so they know where to look for him if he does not check in. He also has set up a WhatsApp check-in so that we know he's okay without him having to make long-distance calls. Provide clarity about your wishes if you do die or do get very hurt while you're overseas. And this means a will, a trust, a living will, those sorts of things. All those things we put off, this is your call to just start doing it and at least get something written down now. And then you can take that to a lawyer and get that executed legally. Have a power of attorney that if you are incapacitated, have that in place so that there is a designated person who is authorized from the state side to take care of things, and be clear in the power of attorney that it can be used internationally. Another thing is decide clearly on remains repatriation. What do I mean by this? There was a lot of struggle in the story about getting his daughter's remains back into the country, which was expensive and a pain in the butt. I have another friend who lost her husband in Greece. He drowned, and she went through all of this while actually on the ground in Greece because she was there with him when he died. And what she did is she ended up looking into the ritual that they use for funerals and remains in Greece, and she decided to leave his remains there. And what they do there is they put your remains in a box, and I think they bury it, and then your flesh is all eaten, and it becomes just bones. I don't know if they put insects in there to help with that process. And then a year later, you go back and you get your loved one's bones, and then you can do with their bones what you will. She decided to do that process rather than bring her husband back to the United States because she felt that that still honored him. And we had a memorial here without the remains on site, which was fine as well. If you have thought about what you would want done with your remains and whether or not you actually care about having them repatriated, that can really help your loved one know they're doing the right thing if they're taking care of you from being deceased overseas. Obtain more copies of the death certificate than you ever think you'll ever need in 100 million years, by which I mean 10 to 20 copies of that death certificate that are certified copies. It's astounding to me, having just gone through the process of losing my stepfather, how many times we've needed an official copy of his death certificate. And we went out of the chute with 20. We have not run out yet, but it's kind of close. So just do with that information what you will. Now, if that death certificate is coming out of another country, like, imagine how fun that's going to be to go back and get additional copies of that. You can get comprehensive travel and health insurance to help in situations like this. So if you know you're going to be abroad for a number of years, or even on a 3 or 4 week trip through Europe, you can definitely get insurance policies that help with things. Medical emergencies are big. I have a friend who was stuck in England for 6 weeks after a terrible car accident, and they did not know how to give her health care beyond keeping her alive. So the quality of care she got, because they didn't have a way to bill her insurance that she had, that was just her primary health insurance plan here, didn't work with their system there. And had she had an extra travel insurance policy, she would have been better off. What ultimately ended up happening is she was stable enough to be flown back to the United States, which was expensive, so that she could finally get some of the surgeries and other things she needed as a result of that car accident. You don't want to be rotting away in a hospital for 6 weeks because you can't travel, with no way to just, like, they wouldn't let her just pay for it with cash, by the way. It was a problem. So travel health insurance is definitely something to look into. And depending on where you're traveling to, you want to see what the standards are in that country so that what you have is tailored to them. And then also, if you can, include an emergency insurance policy for flying you home. Another friend of mine was on Mount Everest, and he became sick at the high altitudes because he had the capacity to quickly be flown out of that situation, he's alive today, and I believe he's tried to hike Everest a second time at this point. Definitely register your trip if you can with, you know, any embassies that are important, especially if you're going to be there for a long time, especially if you live there. And then if you have the time, it doesn't hurt to prepare a personal letter of guidance that your loved ones have access to. This is what we refer to in our family as the if I die or when I die letter. My mom updates hers once a year. I know where it is. It's a shared document. I actually haven't read it, although I could go in there right now and read it. That can provide a lot of comfort for anybody who needs to help you. So these are just some other things I was thinking about as I listened to that episode, and I hope this helps you prepare for any trips abroad and that you have a great time traveling. Make it a great week.
Great advice for Nicole. And I just want to reinforce that there are two types of ways this happens. One is, and they're both tragic, obviously, but one is you're on vacation or your loved one's on vacation, something terrible happens. An older person has a heart attack, you get hit by a car or what have you. But you were never planning to, you're not there, you're not living there. And that is not what our guest had going on. And when that happens, if you're traveling internationally, you might want to check to just simple travel insurance. It is very inexpensive, usually around $30 to $40 that will include things like if you die, they will get your body home for your family. And there's probably not a better deal in that horrible situation than that. And if it's your loved one and you're concerned that something could happen, you could even fit the bill for them, right? If they're cheap or whatever, you know. And then there's the way that our guest had it, where the person's actually living there. And that is a more complex situation. A lot of times when people are on vacation, there is a constant contact with them, and they're, you know, if they're on a cruise or something, then there's some logistics there or what have you. Where if someone's living in a place, you know, we often go long periods of time without talking to people much, even people that we care about. You know, I get a text message, you don't really know what's going on, or when somebody's on vacation, you kind of keep an eye on them. And so they're just two different situations, and it's something to think about. The power of attorney is incredibly important, and it's something that, it can be a hard topic to discuss with people, like your parents and what have you. They have a fear sometimes that means you're trying to take something from them or control their lives or make decisions on their behalf. And the important thing is probably the earlier you get it done, the better, is for them to understand that it's completely on them what the requirements are or the contingencies are in their attorney. And it is the case that, you know, you can have a general power of attorney for someone in the case of incapacitation, and until the point where that person is incapacitated or deceased, you don't have anything. You have a piece of paper that, along with about $6, you can go get a crappy coffee at Starbucks. That's all you have. And, you know, that's why I really recommend that if you have, like, you're somebody, you know, it's like 25, 30 years old right now, and you have parents that are in their 50s or early 60s, you could probably have this conversation with them, and it's not going to be difficult for them to like, go, oh, okay, yeah, we should do that. You start having this conversation with somebody in their 80s, and I'm just going to say there's things about our mentality that change as we age, and we start to think of others maybe trying to get what we have, even if we don't have anything, that type of thing. And the earlier you can have this discussion, the better. And if you're the person that's, you know, my age or older, and you have younger kids, and they're not thinking this way, you need to take the initiative and do this and be the grown-up, all right? All right, so let's go on to my topic. I want to kind of expand on some of the stuff we talked about this week. The great monetary divide yesterday, the enemies of the people show we did this week. We hit on a lot of things that I'm not ready to completely move away from yet. And I did hit on this yesterday, that the group of people I'm most concerned for are like the 30 to 40-year-olds right now. And I try to be careful whenever I put an age range on things. You can be 60 and totally screwed. You could be 15 and totally screwed if you take the wrong course through life, you know. And when I say 30 to 40, it's just kind of hitting that spot where I think you're the most vulnerable. But if you're 29, it's not like you don't have to worry about it. Or you're 41, you can just check out on this segment. But we have a period of flux that we're not, it's not coming at this point. It's here and it's going to continue to unwind. And it is a decade that I called a decade before it happened. I was saying back in 2009, 2010, the decade between 2020 and 2030 will be the largest decade of flux that any living person has ever seen. And one of the largest in recorded history, that if you went to sleep on January 1, 2020, and you woke up on, you know, December 31st, 2031, you know, 2030, right before you went to 2031, you might not even recognize the world you're sitting in. Now, when I say that, I think sometimes people think of it like a sci-fi thing I'm saying. Like, all of a sudden you're going to wake up and there's going to be flying cars and transporters and replicators. And I don't mean that. I just mean, look at the flux that's happened from 2020 to now. And I think some of the dramatic flux has been somewhat muted in our minds because of the whole couple years of COVID stupidity. But, I mean, really, if you think about it, like, do you know that the first LLM, large language model, like ChatGPT, came out in 2018, and nobody was, you know, you had to be a computer nerd to even know it happened, let alone be using it. But ChatGPT itself didn't launch until November 30th, 2022. It's less than 3 years old right now. There's a whole bunch of you that use this tool in your life on a daily basis. It didn't even exist 4 years ago. When the pandemic started, nobody knew what it was. It didn't exist yet. The versions of it that did exist, no one was using it unless you were a super nerd. That's just one example. Now, how much has this already radically transformed our world? People are now learning at a rate beyond what was possible before it. If you're using this as a learning tool, you know what I mean. Businesses are replacing coders with this tool, okay? Businesses are replacing marketing firms and consultants with this tool, and I could keep going, but this is not really about AI. That's just an example. It's just an example because it's not just about emerging technologies that are going to create all the flux. It's also that we're really hitting an inflection point where we've run out the value of the dollar. And that's why we're taking this Hail Mary pass where they're going to, you know, take stable coins and send them out to the world to try to defuse inflation. I think it'll work some, but it's not going to work enough. In fact, stalling it may actually make it worse for people in that target age range right now. Again, because if you're 30 to 40 right now, over the next 5 years, you're going to go to 35 and 45, and then five more years, 40 and 50. You're in a zone where if you are not, if you've been successful, but you get derailed, it is very hard to put your life back together at that point. It's not impossible, but it's difficult, especially if everybody else is trying to do it at the same time. A lot of our parents hit that age bracket in the middle of the 1970s, and they got full-on steamrolled. So I'm not talking about the end of the world as we know it. I'm talking about the end of the good life for a segment of society that has thought, I got it. I got this. I got it made. I made it, you know. What's going on is things like wages lagging inflation. That's always been the case, but this is becoming more the case now. Inflation has become so consistently beyond what it's supposed to be by their own plan, which is already cancer, that we're having that spread continue. And you listen now and you hear people making salaries that if you're my age, you think back, if I was 25 and I was making that money 25 years ago, I wouldn't complain about anything, and you wouldn't have. But then when you actually start saying, well, what does it mean to make that money now, and you're 28 years old and you don't have your first house yet, and you have a big car payment, you have a car payment that's equal to the house payment that I had when I was 25 years old, and you realize it's not as much as you think. Well, like, I just read that almost everybody at Costco that's full-time now makes at least $30 an hour. Now, for a guy, like my first job I made $4 an hour at. My first job after I got out of the military, like real job, like W-2 job, not under the table bouncer money or something like that, I made $5.90 an hour. That would have been 1993. It took me a couple years to get in, you know, for a couple years I ended up making decent money in optical fiber and outside plant construction, but you're talking $14-15 an hour. And I had to kill myself, and I was like running crews for that money. The people that worked for me were making $10-12, and you're going to get $30 an hour to like run stuff over a scanner? You get $30 an hour to check people out? I go to Albertsons and check myself out. I'm qualified for a $30 an hour job. Wow, that's really good, Mike. You know, nobody should be crying or anything. But, I mean, we're talking $1,200 a week. I ain't take home either. That's your gross, right? So we're, like, talking 62 and change, right? $62,000 salary and change annually. Okay, and you know what? If you are where I was, when I was making $5.90 an hour, I was 21 years old, just out of the Army. I was single, had a roommate, shared an apartment, and I was willing to drive whatever I could get my hands on to drive a car. It's not bad, is it? I mean, it really isn't. But, you know, if you go to Costco and you walk around and you look at the people they're paying this money to, it ain't a bunch of 22-year-old kids. These are grown-ass adults, and they're working hard, you know, and they're doing their job, and they're, you know, they're maintaining a lot of shit, and they work a lot of hours you don't want to work and everything. You know, if that person's got a couple kids, if their wife has an equivalent income or their husband has equivalent income, they can do all right, but they're not. It sounds like a lot more than it is, and that's only going to become more the case. It is almost when you have people working in a place like Costco making $30 an hour, Walmart, most people are making 20, and you see the caliber of the people making this money. Man, I got to tell you, you're at a point now where we've pushed the wage to where we're pushing the inflation. And it's going to take a heroic thing to change it. And that's why I think Trump's doing the gambit with the tariffs and trying to rebuild American, you know, manufacturing and production. But I don't know if it's going to work. We also have a housing affordability crisis. And this is where I'm saying, like, young people will have time to adapt to the new world. When I say young, I mean their kids still. They're barely wiping their own ass. I'm talking about, you know, when you get 30 to 40-year-olds right now, if they don't have a house yet, you got a real problem. And if you do have a house, but you can barely make your house payment, and these housing valuations keep going up, well, I bought a house, now at least my mortgage won't go up. And then, you know, the god of taxes laughs at you because your property taxes are going up every year or every other year. You know, and most places now have something in place, like once you hit 65, that locks your taxes. When you're 40, that's forever and a day away. So we have affordability of housing to even get into a house right now is insane to me. And where I realize how insane is when I look at, like, if I have good credit and I got money. If I just decided I wanted a new car right now, and I'm not going to be stupid about it, I'm going to go out and buy a $35,000-$40,000 car on a standard 5-year loan. And I'm going to bring to the dealership $5,000 on top of my freaking grade A credit and put it down. How much money is it going to cost? About $800 a fucking month. Well, then I'm sitting there going, how the hell is a person that makes, you know, $30 an hour, which sounds like good money, going to buy a freaking house for $350,000? And in a lot of places, you can barely get anything for that. Job security is going to shit on top of all this. So even if you're in a place where, I can cover everything. Traditional career paths offer very few benefits anymore. Nowhere near the stability they used to, and they don't have a lot of long-term growth. You can make really good money working for Costco. But it's like any other corporation. It's a pyramid with a very small number of people at upper levels. So there's not a whole lot of difference between the run-a-day worker and the shift manager. You know, the only person in that one Costco location is probably the general manager, who is significantly above everybody else, and everybody else is significantly above is at some sort of regional level or also running an individual general management of a facility. There's just not that much upward momentum in the jobs that do pay good, and how long do you think we're going to really need people doing a lot of these jobs? I mean, I'm pretty skeptical on the whole Optimus robot thing and all, but there is going to come a point where that shit starts to take over, and it's probably within the next 10 years. So we have the AIs are competing for the code type work and the white collar work, and in time you're going to see a lot more of the mechanical intelligence, right? Mechanical AIs start to compete for human labor. And it doesn't, here's what you have to understand, it doesn't have to mean that everybody loses their job. If you put the world into a state where, like, there's 10% less jobs than people willing to work, the employers then go, oh, I see. And they start whittling away wages on the few humans that they still need to hire. And then on top of all this, we live in a completely debt-driven lifestyle. I know people that make really good money. They don't need to be out spending all kinds of money in debt, but they are. I know people that are spending $900, $1,000 a month to drive a car on a lease. On a lease. Like, I'm a fan of leasing the right vehicle in the right situation for the right reason, but it ain't that. A three-year lease? You're going to spend $36,000 on a Grand Cherokee? And at the end of those 3 years, all you get is a pat on the head, and they take your car away, and it's gone? And again, it is people in that age block, 30 to 40, that are largely living this way. Many of the people that are in that age block right now as well, they're college-degreed professionals. But what you have your degree in, maybe you're not even working in, but the ones that are, your degree might not be worth a damn in 10 years. I got a degree plus 20 years of experience. Yeah, and nobody needs anybody to do that anymore. And the erosion, this is the big thing, though, is the erosion of the savings and retirement. There are so many people out there that look at that 401k and they feel really good about it, but they have not done the math. What will that 401k look like in 15 years when you retire? What will your expenses be? And how far will it really go? It might look like a big number, but will it actually do what you need it to do at that point? Because we have a tendency to just not want to look at things that are ugly for us, right? People love to look at, like, reality TV and non-reality TV and, you know, wrecks on TV and fires and everything. But when it's our own life, our own future, we tend to just want to, like, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. Man, I'm telling you, the devaluation of the currency may be forestalled a little bit here, but it is continuing unabated. So what do you do if this is you? Number one, you need to constantly be developing new skill sets. You have to. You have to constantly be looking for where is a place that I can make more money, whether it's moving over to move up, like changing a job, whether it is adding on a certification or a skill set that actually has some legs to it for a time, whether it's building a side hustle or a business, something. You got to do it. You got to start saving and investing your money in lasting assets. You know I'm going to say Bitcoin, and if you don't want to hear it, I'm sorry. What am I going to tell you? Don't invest in the best investment you can make right now. Don't save with the strongest savings vehicle that's ever existed. You don't want to, don't. But I'm going to just tell you that there isn't a person that's been listening to me for more than 10 years that hasn't heard me say it for more than 10 years. And there's only two kinds of people out of that group. People that did it and are grateful, and people who didn't and wish they did. So you do with that as you will. But you've got to understand that the world that we're moving through now, not we're heading into, that we're moving through right now, is different than any time in our history. We have never been, and when I say our history, I mean this country, Okay? I'm talking like from the founders to now. We've never been in a situation quite like this from a monetary standpoint and a tech evolution standpoint at the same time. While our technology is becoming the most powerful that we could imagine it to be, our money's becoming as weak as possible. It's an inverse ratio. And that is not a good place to be as a worker. Right? Your money's worth less and your labor is worth less at the same time. That's the problem. It wasn't that long ago, if you were a young guy, 25 years old, you could have had an 8th grade reading level education. But if you had good morality, you knew how to show up on time, not get in fights with people, whatever, and you were willing to physically work, you could just make a good living. And if you were really willing to work, even in a job that didn't pay that good, you know, I remember making $14-15 an hour. I also remember making $50,000 a year doing it. And those numbers don't work out on a 40-hour week, do they? No, because if you were willing to work, you could get overtime. And if you couldn't get overtime, you could take that skill and go contract when you weren't employed, you know, when you weren't working your 40 hours, you go work for somebody else as a straight-up contractor. I did that too. And when my dad was the age I was when I was doing it, it was even more available to do something like that. My old man back in the early 70s was making the kind of money a general practice doctor made as a highway construction worker. And that world is gone and everybody knows it's gone, but you don't understand. It's like it's going away. We are in they call a waning gibbous of the moon. Right? Like, so the moon runs through its 30-day or 28-day cycle, right? It starts out full, and then it wanes, it goes down to half a moon, and then waning crescent is what I'm actually looking at. When you get down a little sliver, and it's going away, and it's going to be a new moon soon and dark, that's where we are. We're in that waning crescent phase of the economy. And this is at least a 50-year cycle. It's a long way to come back. Yes, yesterday I said that maybe we're heading into a first turning. But what I've tried to give you with that is, and that's great if you're 15. It ain't so great if you're 30. At least not for everyone. So please double down on your efforts to prepare for your own economic future. Double down on your efforts to prepare for your own skill set development. The good news is there's never been a better time or easier time to learn as much as possible. There never has. There's never been a time where it's easier to find opportunities. And the key is going to be the person that can find the opportunity the fastest, capitalize the best, and do the most with the results of it, and waste the least while they're at it. That's who's going to win, especially out of you guys, again, you younger guys and you not so younger guys in that delta. That if you're 30 to 40 right now, you're in that delta. And again, if you're 28, it doesn't mean you're free and clear. And if you're 42, it doesn't mean you're free and clear. That's just the bullseye. And then you got the periphery, and it's still a pretty hot target. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys enjoyed this week. It was kind of my first week of being fully back after having a pretty gnarly flu for a couple weeks. Even when it was gone, I was just tired. I feel great. I'm really excited to meet some of you guys tomorrow, some for the first time. Some I know there's a couple people going that I know will be there that I've met before. And we'll process some beef together. That's a good skill to have. And you will have a Friday flashback tomorrow, and then we will come back next week and we will do it all over again. And then next week, I'm actually going to be on Tom Woods' podcast. He's interviewing me on Tuesday, but I don't think he broadcasts live the way that I do, so I don't know when that'll come out. But we're going to be talking about, guess what? AI, artificial intelligence. Tom's a bit of a skeptic. I reached out to him and said, hey, I think maybe I can turn things around for you and some of your listeners, so he's going to have me on. So Gen X and Boomer talk AI. That should be fun. And when that's available, I'll let you know. Take care, guys. Have a great weekend. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.
show you a better way.